Well, I'm very pleased indeed to welcome everyone again to our third session now with Professor Babu, who's going to speak to us on Hegel, if I believe.
That's right, yes.
On the title is, you have to remind me of
It's called Cross-Cultural Hermeneutics After Hegel.
Yes, Cross-Cultural Hermeneutics After Hegel. So I'm very interested to hear what will be said.
Okay, thank you, Gavin, and thank you all for coming. This is a seminar which goes on till 3:30, so I'll plan to speak for about 50 minutes because it's a fairly dense paper. But to make it perhaps a little less dense and more comprehensible, I might remark that it's sort of taken from a book that I've been working on for off and on for 8 years and hope to bring to completion very soon. And it might help, I think, to contextualize the paper, to situate it within the book, because I've sort of drawn it from the book. So the book is called Hegel, India, and the Dark Face of Modernity, and has three parts, and this paper, in a sense, draws on two of those parts. And so the three parts are a sort of depth hermeneutic of Hegel's extensive writings on India. And Hegel, especially in his mature Berlin period, stretching from 1821 to just before his death in 1831, gave four sets of lectures, 1821, 24, 27, and then, as I said, in 1831, on India. And for someone who did not really, at that time and place, have access to the materials that the East India Company and the India Office had, it's astounding how much Hegel had read and continued to read. And that's the interesting point. And this section of the book is already 200 pages has, I'm going to sort of summarize or at least the one or two main motifs. One motif is, as you'll see from the paper that I read, that Hegel is consistently sort of negative, unlike Schopenhauer, for example, and perhaps even Schelling. Hegel is consistently negative about India, but yet he can't get India out of his system. And unlike China and any other sort of non-European culture, it's India he keeps returning to obsessively. And as I said, just 3 weeks before he dies from cholera, he continues to give a series of lectures on Indian philosophy and law. And so the intellectual puzzle that I sort of try to grapple with is why he's so obsessed with India, and why, even though he's negative, it's interesting to read the subtle changes, right? And just to give you one idea of a subtle change, Hegel in the 1827 lectures, and then he repeats that compliment again in 1831, sort of compares parts of Indian idealism to Spinoza, which, for those of you who know Hegel, is a very high compliment to put him put Indian thought at that level. But nonetheless, there's no gainsaying the fact that he is negative, and as I say, therein hangs a tale. Second part is, after these 200 pages, is what I call the philosophical, or the contours of philosophical modernity. And the argument that I end up with at the end of that first section is to say that there is much more going on than just a cultural fascination. And again, to summarize a quite complex argument of intellectual and philosophical history. What's going on is the working out of the philosophical contours of modernity. Hegel's disciple, in a way, though he might balk at being called a Hegelian disciple, but my teacher, Jürgen Habermas, wrote a book, a quite influential book, called The Philosophical Discourse of Modernity. And without Habermas going into this particular study of intellectual history, certainly recognizes that it's Hegel who is the at least in the German context, the philosopher of modernity, was sort of trying to work out both the conceptual and the institutional contours of modernity in terms of the structures of modern society, families, civil society, state, structures of law, and so on. So the second part, which follows from the first, is that part of what Hegel is trying to do is to indicate that Europe and Germany has reached a philosophical fork in the road, and one fork, one sort of deviation goes in the direction of the Romantics, among whom Hegel himself grew up. I mean, Schelling, the Schlegel brothers, Novalis, and so on, who looked to India, and this is a very interesting academic and institutional story. They looked to India as the land of origins and as the place where Germany and Europe had to go back to get a sort of cultural and spiritual regeneration, much the way in which Greece had served that role for European thought up to that time. I mean, the Renaissance, as you know, goes back to the Greek and Roman classics. And the Romantics had suggested fairly persuasively that India needed to fulfill this role. And this for a very interesting reason, for those of you who are Sanskritists, because the study, the detailed study of Indian and Sanskrit philology and around the field of Indology was really getting off the ground there. The first chair of Indology, which was occupied by Friedrich Schlegel in Bonn in 1808, and then subsequently led to chairs in Leipzig and in other places around Germany. There are three disciplines that around this discovery of Sanskrit are crucial in this context. One is Indology and philology. The second is folklore and anthropology, all right? And there are chairs coming up as well. I mean, think of the Grimm brothers as one example, all right? And their sort of comparative study of folklore and stories from around the world. And the third is the burgeoning study of linguistics that, again, and it's interesting to know, for those of you, again, who are Sanskritists, that the great German Sanskritist and philologist Franz Bopp was Hegel's contemporary and colleague in Berlin, and Hegel would consult Bopp quite a lot. You can see why, as another point of interest for us and obviously for Hegel, that he thinks India is important is because, as I've just indicated, the Romantics, when they discovered the complexity and the subtlety of Sanskrit grammar, which they thought was far more subtle than either Greek or Latin, then, like in the case of Schlegel, who wrote an important book called
Die Sprache und Weisheit der Inder, the language and the wisdom of Indians, again a very powerful text in its time, came up with a philosophy of history that said, look, one can trace a narrative of history that marks a spiritual decline from the glory days of Sanskrit and the Indian spiritual classics. And so if Europe wants to regenerate itself, it's got to go back to that particular era and immerse itself in those texts. Hegel's philosophy of history is the inverse of this, where Schlegel says everything sort of starts in India and the East and then, you know, marks a period of decline. Hegel turns that the other way around and says, no, it's the India represents the infancy, the sort of childhood, and you'll see some of his rhetorical sort of tropes marking that particular narrative, whereas we in Europe now represent the mature wisdom. And the philosophical discourse of modernity that Hegel sort of maps out has these two components, at least, this philosophy of history that I've just pointed to, but also the fact that the institutions that Europe is working out in both the university and then in civil society in the state are in fact far more mature institutions. And so in his lectures on politics and sociology, it's a sort of marked feature that that Hegel takes Indian institutions like the family, like the state, and compares them negatively with their European counterparts. And it's also interesting, I mean, in America, there's a nice Yiddish word for it, chutzpah, for those of you who come from the American context, because it turns out that Wilhelm von Humboldt, the great scholar of the humanities, who was the culture minister in Berlin at the time and who knew Sanskrit, wrote a detailed study of the Bhagavad Gita in 1827. And Hegel, without knowing any Sanskrit, takes his own culture minister on whom he depends for his job to some extent. This should give heart to those of you who are in the job market that sometimes chutzpah works, but most of the time it doesn't. Anyway, and says, no, the very flattering account that von Humboldt gives of the Bhagavad Gita is quite wrong. And Hegel then goes on to come up with this philosophical critique, which is along roughly the same lines, that the Bhagavad Gita is still a very passive and a very inauspicious text for the, you know, the hard work of modernity. As I say, there's an exchange between von Humboldt and Hegel on this point. So the third section is a section where I say, look, this is not just a historical debate, because the legacy of Hegel in some forms sort of continues into our present time, because there's still, and I illustrate this with a detailed study of Max Weber and of Jürgen Habermas, where as two important 20th century thinkers, this Hegelian motif that it's Europe who, at Max Weber's famous sociology begins by and continues to ask the question, what is it, what special characteristics are unique to Europe, such that compared to China and India, and of course, as those of you know who worked on Weber, he is a comparative sociologist looking at many different cultures, and this is in many ways the sort of guiding thread to his entire oeuvre, which is to say, you know, what unique characteristics does Europe and Europe alone have, which the non-European world does not have, right? And in some ways, that sense of self-confidence, if you want to call it that, or hubris, if you want to call it that, continues in someone like Habermas, who, again, as I've said, tries to look at modernity sort of philosophically. So this particular paper, which I've just tried to situate, draws on two parts. It takes a little bit from the first section of the book, the depth hermeneutic, and it talks a little bit about the modernity seen both in a colonial and also in a post-colonial fashion. But the third element that I've added, somewhat cursorily, I have to admit, in this paper, and I'll deal with it more fully when I talk about Raymond Panikkar next week, are the sort of formal epistemological and political requirements of a cross-cultural hermeneutics. It's a very demanding and important task, I would argue, especially at times of cultural exchange and cultural translation. And it's a subject that has not really been dealt with in hermeneutics generally. I mean, people like Gadamer and Ricoeur and others really deal with a set of hermeneutical problems within the sort of European tradition, but with a few exceptions, Panikkar being one of them, very few have dealt with the rigorous requirements of cross-cultural hermeneutics. So I just hinted that, and I want to warn you that section, which I'll develop more fully next Monday, is here just sort of thrown into the discussion without any sort of rigorous treatment. Okay, so that having been said, I have to, again, one last sort of prefatory comment. I'm glad there are a few Hegel scholars here, but I imagine that most of you are not, and you'll see very quickly that Hegel is not easy to understand. This happens to be the 150th anniversary of a book by James Stirling, one of the book written in 1865. Hegel died in 1831. Hegel, who was difficult even for Germans to understand, was sort of doubly difficult for an English-speaking world. But James Stirling's book was called The Secret of Hegel, and the remark was that if Stirling had discovered the secret of Hegel, he kept it to himself. I don't make any pretensions to revealing the secret of Hegel. It might get even more compounded with these two short excerpts that I'm taking, but you've been warned. Okay, all right, so cross-cultural hermeneutics after Hegel. It has become a truism to say that we today live in a global world. Thanks to the marvels of technology, time and space have been contracted and shrunk, and developments in the farthest corners of the world impact us in our living rooms. The internet, jet travel, and immigration have all brought us closer together, at least in the sense of physical and geographical proximity, but such a proximity does not necessarily betoken a deeper understanding and acceptance of one another. On the contrary, globalization has also produced covert imperialism, savage ethnic tribalisms, and religious fundamentalisms, such as we have just experienced and witnessed in Paris and elsewhere, Beirut, that alienate and exclude people from circles of acceptance and respect. In general, it is fair to say that globalization has thus far taken a largely economic and technological form, but that cultural and spiritual globalization, at least in the limited sense of mutual respect and appreciation of people who have been physically brought closer together, has thus far lagged far behind. It is in this particular context that I want to place cross-cultural hermeneutics.
Cross-cultural hermeneutics is the attempt to traverse cultural boundaries and enter the horizon and worldview of another culture, sometimes quite foreign to our own. We know from Heidegger and Hans-Georg Gadamer and Ricoeur that we understand because we are already in a hermeneutic circle. But how do we understand something that is foreign to our circle? If, for example, a Westerner attempts to understand the various meanings of the Indic Sanskrit word dharma, dharam, which is usually translated as law, duty, right, R-I-G-H-T, right, R-I-T-E, way of life, etc., it quickly becomes apparent that the word has meaning only within a cosmological moral framework that is quite different from the social world of the modern West. We are involved here in a meaning holism that requires us to understand a social whole alongside any particular concept and to deploy a whole part dialectic where each sheds light on the other. Ramon Panikkar defines the particular hermeneutic required in the case of cross-cultural understanding as a diatopical hermeneutics, because we are trying to bridge the distance between two or more cultures which have different horizons of intelligibility, or topoi, to use the Greek word, and different worldviews. There is a whole set of epistemological and moral political conditions for such understanding, which I hope at least partially to elucidate in this presentation. I shall do so, however, through three historical epochs, three historical moments in the trajectory of cross-cultural hermeneutics. The point of this historical exercise is to illustrate, by default as it were, the requirements, both formal and material, of cross-cultural hermeneutics. So in my first section, I want to begin by showing a few aspects of Hegel's encounter with India. So this first section is called Hegel's Encounter with India. Hegel deals with India most fully in his Berlin period, starting from 1820 and extending till 1831, and particularly in the lecture series that he repeated often on the philosophy and history of religions, aesthetics, law and society, and world history. By this time, of course, in his development, his own philosophical position has been worked out, and there has been some debate as to whether Hegel approached Indian philosophy and culture in a completely a prioristic manner. As I hope to demonstrate, he clearly approached his study of India with philosophical and political axes to grind, but being the thorough and rigorous thinker that he was, he felt he had to take account of and absorb the ever more detailed and complex material coming his way, thanks to the work of German and English Indologists. I shall abstract here from detailed considerations of a depth hermeneutic of Hegel's views of India, which, as I've indicated earlier, I've done in the first 200 pages of the book I mentioned, given that in this context I'm using Hegel primarily for illustrative purposes. Perhaps the best way to encapsulate his critique of Indian tradition is to provide two references from his work, which I think might give a succinct indication of his views. And I'm giving you two quotations from Hegel, which you will immediately recognize because the prose is so remarkably different. For the most well-developed form of pantheism, we may refer to the Indian religion. This full development is characterized by the fact that the absolute substance, the one itself, is conceived of as existing in the form of thought, as distinct from the accidental world. This religion accounts for the relation of man and God, and being pantheist, it does not isolate the one in pure objectivity, which metaphysics does. It is important to emphasize this peculiar subjectivization of substance. Conscious thought does not simply make this abstraction of substance, it is itself that abstraction. It is that one which exists by and for itself, and which is this substance. This thought is known as a force which creates and sustains the world and changes its individual modes of existence. This thought is called Brahman, and exists as the natural consciousness of the Brahmins and of others who achieve the complete extinction of the manifold contents of consciousness, of all emotions and sensual and intellectual interests, and reduce everything to the complete simplicity and emptiness of substantial oneness. In this way, this thought, this abstraction of man in himself, is conceived of as a great force. This force unfolds itself wildly by transforming itself into its opposite. We are faced with uninhibited lunacy, where the most ordinary presence is immediately raised to the rank of the divine, and the one and only substance is conceived of in a finite form which may dissolve itself as quickly as it has been conceived of. All right, this is from Hegel's Lectures on the Philosophy of Religion. So here's my commentary, very quick. In this one passage, we see the thrust of Hegel's criticisms of Indian philosophical theology. Number one, in Hegel's terminology, Indian thought remains substantial. All right, this is not a very good term for Hegel, because his chosen category is subject rather than substance, and has not advanced to the crucial stage of subject, that is, of self-conscious rational subjectivity. Rather, as he says, there is a peculiar subjectivization of substance, an abstract combination and mixing up of the two categories, rather than a dialectical mediation. As a result, the proper relation of the infinite and the finite, God and man, has not been articulated. The infinite has not posited the finite as his dialectical other, nor does the finite affect and play an essential role in the constitution and determination of the infinite. Number two, Indian pantheism, therefore, according to Hegel, is a wild, inherently unstable affair, continually swinging from the monism of the one to the polytheism of the many, from the abstraction of Brahman to the dissipation of this abstraction into its opposite, where, to quote Hegel, the most ordinary presence is immediately raised to the rank of the divine. 3. India, says Hegel elsewhere, is a land of dream and fantasy and not of reason, incapable of the analytical distinctions and dialectical subtleties which have been accomplished only by the hard European intellect. India, for Hegel, exhibited the same tendencies in the spiritual development of humankind as a whole as the mental condition of a person dreaming just before he or she awakes. 4. As a result, it is inappropriate here to talk of a rational freedom in history. The practical consequences of this lazy dreaming is the escapism inherent in Indian yogic and religious practice, where practitioners achieve the complete extinction of the manifold contents of consciousness and take refuge, as Hegel says, in the emptiness of substantial oneness. With reference to political thought and life, Hinduism, for Hegel, is irredeemably a religion of unfreedom. Hence we find Hegel writing, and this is the second quote from his Philosophy of History, "In India, the primary aspect of subjectivity, viz. That of the imagination, presents a union of the natural and the spiritual, in which nature on the one hand does not present itself as a world embodying reason, nor the spiritual on the other hand as consciousness in contrast with nature. Freedom, both as abstract will and as subjective freedom, is absent. The proper basis of the state, the principle of freedom, is altogether absent. There cannot therefore be any state in the true sense of the term. Hindu political existence presents us with a people, but no state. What may be called a relic of political life in India is a despotism without a principle, without any rule of morality and religion. For morality and religion have as their indispensable condition and basis the rational freedom of the will. In the case of such a, this is still Hegel, in the case of such a people, therefore, that which we call in its double sense history is not to be looked for. For history requires understanding, the power of looking at an object in an independent, objective light, and comprehending it in its rational connection with other objects. The Hindus, on the contrary, exhibit the contradictory processes of a dissolution of fixed, rational, and definite conceptions in their ideality, and on the other side, a degradation of this ideality to a multiformity of sensuous objects. This makes them incapable of writing history. All that happens is dissipated in their minds into confused dreams. This is from the Philosophy of History. So, here's my commentary. Instead of the rational determinations characteristic of the state, we have Oriental despotism, a term applied to Asian politics originally by Montesquieu in The Spirit of the Laws, but deduced as the necessary character of a people who, in their propensity for dreamy fantasies and uncontrolled imagination, lack objectivity and a rational will, and therefore invite the capricious and arbitrary rule of omnipotent autocrats. Given the panlogism of Hegel's system, the two critiques that I presented, metaphysical religious in the first quote and political in the second, are reducible to a basic philosophical point with ramifications in many different areas, namely the lack of dialectical mediation in Indian thought. The Indian mind, given as it is to dream and imagination, is incapable of the analytical distinctions and categorical differentiations so uniquely displayed in European thought. As interesting as the philosophical diagnosis, however, are the rhetorical images in which it is expressed. India is variously presented as being in a delirious opium bliss, escapist, childish, feminine, passive, and submissive, a country, in other words, ready for conquest. Its place on the panorama of world history is that of an archaic, primitive culture, now wholly absorbed and superseded within mature European civilization. It is instructive to probe into the epistemological strategies underlying such a harsh negative verdict. There are perhaps four interrelated features of Hegel's Orientalist narrative, which from this perspective I wish to highlight and comment on. First, Hegel's unquestioned and triumphalistic Eurocentrism. Second, his stance towards otherness and difference. Third, the temporal and spatial distancing of Indian culture and its consignment to an archaic past. And fourth, the particular relation of the knower to the known. So, number one, Hegel's Eurocentrism. I think I've said enough already to make good this charge. What is fascinating, however, in as rigorous a thinker as Hegel, is to observe the way in which such Eurocentrism is both explained and legitimated. Logical system and historical development are perfectly fused in Hegel's thought. Philosophy, therefore, not only has a history, it is its own history, so that the sequence of philosophical systems in history mirrors advances in logic. Absolute spirit, both the telos and the ground of Hegel's system, is both all-comprehending and, in the process, self-comprehending. The self-transparency thesis that Hegel sometimes demonstrates, especially in his logic, and this consummation is modern Europe's unique achievement. The sun may rise in the east, but it sets in the west, and it is from the west that the owl of Minerva spreads its wings. This is a metaphor that and a trope that Hegel keeps referring to, the owl of Minerva going from east to west. Hegel is by no means unique in this Eurocentrism for people writing in his time and place, a posture adopted by most of the thinkers of his time, although he alone provides, as far as I know, a logico-historical explanation and justification for such Eurocentrism. This should not be surprising if one considers the balance of economic, political, and cultural power at the time. This Eurocentrism has at least two distinct but related aspects. First, the denial of rationality, self-determination, and ultimately of humanity itself to non-European peoples. And second, an essentialist idea of human nature and what it means to be human, which supports such a denial. The ascription of barbarism and primitiveness to Asian people is a form of historical social Darwinism culminating in white European man, where all three predicates, whiteness, Europeanness, and maleness, where all three predicates, although not explicitly spelt out, quite obviously represent an equation of particular forms of rationality, freedom, and culture with humanity and human nature as such. Second, Hegel's stance towards otherness and difference. The irony of such Eurocentrism in Hegel's case is that he is reputed to be a philosopher of difference, whose dialectic is driven by the negativity posed by alterity. As many commentators from Kierkegaard and Adorno to Levinas and Derrida more recently have pointed out, however, the other as other, with her own agency and self-understanding, is not seen in her irreducible exteriority, but rather aufgehoben, that's transcended, it's a difficult term to explain in English, and reabsorbed within the self-identity of spirit. Consequently, as Immanuel Levinas has expressed it succinctly, alterity has no singular metaphysical standing outside what is ontologically the same. It is simply a moment within the logic of the same. And this is a quote from Levinas. Hegelian phenomenology, whose self-consciousness is the distinguishing of what is not really distinct, expresses the universality of the same, identifying itself in the alterity of objects thought and despite the opposition of self to self. That's taken from Levinas's Totality and Infinity. This relentless identitätslogik, identity logic, to use Theodor Adorno's term, the distinguishing of what is not ontologically really distinct, is clearly displayed in Hegel's treatment of India. On the one hand, from a historical and cultural standpoint, Hegel wants to make the spiritual distancing as great as possible. Here's a quote from his Philosophy of History. The European who goes from Persia to India observes, therefore, a prodigious contrast when he comes to India. Whereas in the former country, Persia, he finds himself still somewhat at home, as soon as he crosses the Indus, he encounters the most repellent characteristics pervading every single feature of society. That's from the Philosophy of History. On the other hand, however, these threatening differences are not allowed to stand, and from an ontological standpoint are brought within a unitary and linear evolutionary history of absolute spirit and consigned to a primitive stage of such a history, now altogether surpassed in European modernity. The primitiveness is conveyed most powerfully by the image of childishness and dreaminess, which images, in effect, deny his Indian other full selfhood. Nor is much hope provided for change in the future because of the temporal and logical irreversibility of spirit's march through history. Third feature of this narrative, the temporal and spatial distancing. It is no accident that in his Philosophy of History, Hegel conjoins geographical and temporal distancing in his classification of hither and then farther Asia. In his Phenomenology of World Religions, Persian and Egyptian religions are placed in the category of the transition from natural to spiritual religions, that is, as embodying some aspects of self-conscious subjectivity, whereas the religions of China and India are firmly placed in the category of the natural, dominated by notions of substance rather than of rational subjectivity. And within this characterization goes a certain historical revisionism, in that the Chinese and Indian civilizations are treated as the oldest in order to fit in within his particular narrative of world history. Of course, the countries of Africa and Latin America are, from his point of view, off the map, as it were, and treated as non-historical, in contrast to the prehistorical, a distinction which India and China have. Another quote from the Philosophy of History. The Persians are the first historical people. Persia was the first empire that passed away. While China and India remain stationary and perpetuate a natural vegetative existence even to the present time, this land, Persia, has been subject to those developments and revolutions which alone manifest a historical condition. Johannes Fabian, the anthropologist, in his book Time and the Other, How Anthropology Makes Its Object, describes this particular historical differentiation as, within quotes, the denial of coevalness, evil, by which he means both a chronological and qualitative distancing. It is a useful distinction because it allows us to distinguish the pastness of the Greeks, say, from that of the Indians and the Chinese. The former pastness, that is of the Greeks, is primarily a chronological matter because the Greeks, for all their pastness, still share the same thought world as Europeans, whereas the latter, that is the pastness of the Indians and the Chinese, spans not only temporal distance but also a cultural divide, an alienness that has to be both explained and neutralized. Fourth feature of the narrative, the particular relation of the knower to the known. What I wish to highlight here is what Michel Foucault calls the episteme, the mode of knowledge and its structuring by power relationships. This is not at all the same thing as the biases that a person or a culture has vis-à-vis another, which from a structural point of view would count as more epiphenomenal. In other words, depth hermeneutical analysis here acquires a specifically epistemic focus. 3 points may perhaps be made here in summary fashion. First, in terms of social ontology, the relation of knowing subject and known object is not an equal or symmetrical one, even though, given that they are both subjects, intersubjective communicative understanding would seem to be normative. Hegel, as we have seen, denies subjectivity to Indians in their natural vegetative state. The European knower is presented as rational, self-conscious and objective, while Indians are portrayed as irrational, dreamy and subjective. It follows, second, that the Europeans' knowledge of Indians is superior to the Indians' own self-knowledge, which to the extent that they have any, must be inadequate and unscientific because it is irredeemably subjective, immediate, and insofar as it lacks mediating principles, essentially empty or confused. Except for the religious classics and a few texts that came to him from the India office that he read in translation, Hegel's reading about India and Indian philosophy in particular was confined solely to the commentaries written by Europeans. He does not seem to have read a single Indian philosopher except in these few translations that were coming from Colebrook and others. The same is true for Hegel's first-hand knowledge of Indian art, which in his extensive writings and lectures is confined to two actual instances of art. That did not stop him from waxing eloquent about his many deficiencies as a vehicle of spirit. Finally, Hegel seriously believed that Indians were incapable of ever acquiring such knowledge for themselves. Rather, his discourse is confident of its power to represent India, to interpret and explain it not only to the West, but to Indians themselves. Hegel would have been in full agreement with Karl Marx's statement expressed in a somewhat different context, quote, they cannot represent themselves, they must be represented. That's taken from Marx's 18th Brumaire of Napoleon Bonaparte. So, the second historical moment, I said there were three in this presentation, the second is what I'm calling the post-colonial moment. Two events above all mark the great change between Hegel's era and ours. First, the political independence won by former colonial states, matched by a self-assertion that challenges the representations of their erstwhile masters. Second, what has been called the politics of difference, the challenging of long-established cultural and political hegemonies and dominant worldviews, practices, and institutions. Questions of race, ethnicity, class, and gender are now seen as crucial elements in the deconstruction of hegemonic views and attitudes. These two conditions obviously have a lot in common. They represent the empowerment of hitherto subjugated and marginalized groups in their struggle against entrenched establishments. Together they set up what I am calling in this context the postcolonial moment. Postcolonialism is a dialectical concept that marks on the one hand the struggle against colonialism in all its different forms, political, economic, military, and cultural, in the quest for independence and sovereignty, and on the other hand, the grim realities in a new imperialistic context of economic and sometimes cultural political domination that continues. Postcolonial critique marks the stage where the political and cultural experience of the marginalized peripheries of the world ruled by the West could be developed into a more general theoretical position that can be set against Western political, intellectual, and academic hegemony. Postcolonial theory is designed to undo the ideological heritage of colonialism, not only in the decolonized countries, but also in the West. What is attempted is nothing less than a decolonization of the Western mind, a deconstruction of the forms of thought, sensibility, and imagination that led to colonialism in the first place and perpetuate its continuation. This necessarily involves a decentering of the intellectual sovereignty and dominance of Europe and a critique of Eurocentrism, that is, the assumption that the Western point of view is normative and thus is authorized to speak for the rest of the world. The interrogation and decentering of Western knowledge involve, among many other tasks, reappraising its links to colonialism and racism, challenging the many forms of Western history represented as an ordered evolutionary narrative that subsumes and consummates all other histories of the world, and also questioning the literary and cultural canons for their exclusion of writings that have not stemmed from the metropolitan center, and thirdly, developing a dialogical space for the encounter of Western and non-Western cultures as equal partners. It names the activities by which new subaltern histories, new identities, and new conceptualizations of the world, transnational rather than Western, are fashioned, and seeks through them to redress current imbalances of power, wealth, and resources in the pursuit of a more just and equitable world. When we subject the absolutistic, monological, and ethnocentric worldviews of Hegel to postcolonial critique, a space is created for other agencies and voices. Pluralism is not, however, sheer plurality, the mere fact of differences and diversity, but rather the problems, philosophical, political, cultural, that are raised when these different voices debate and contest value judgments, truth claims, and representations. Who gets to represent whom, under what conditions, and for what purposes? How are such representations structured methodologically, epistemically, and morally? What is the relation between power relations and the production and reception of knowledge? What happens to the problematics of truth and validity when considerations of power and rhetoric are introduced? I cannot, obviously, in this presentation, go into all these questions. What I will do in this setting is to return to the four features earlier picked out in Hegel's Orientalist narrative and indicate very briefly how a postcolonial ethos problematizes them. So the first feature is Eurocentrism. The kind of explicit Eurocentrism purveyed by Hegel is now happily a thing of the past, and I doubt it has many serious, by which I mean to be taken seriously, defenders. Of course, at a factual level, there still continue to be nativists and xenophobes, racists and imperialists, about whom I do not need to remind you. But at a philosophical level, the debate has shifted to a somewhat different terrain. On the one hand, there are formalists and transcendentalists like Jürgen Habermas and Karl Otto Appel, who in different ways argue for a universal conception of reason or reasonableness, at least as a way of structuring the public space within which different claims and assertions are raised and validated. On the other hand, there are contextual and hermeneutically minded thinkers like Charles Taylor, Alistair MacIntyre, and Stephen Toulmin, Paul Ricoeur, who countenance culture-specific and culture-relative notions of reason. This is admittedly to frame the debate very crudely and simplistically, but it may suffice to show that what passes for universal, even at the formal transcendental level, hides a certain Eurocentric bias that needs to be deconstructed. There's not much sensitivity to the problems thrown up by cultural pluralism in Jürgen Habermas's communications theoretic idea of public reasons, which even as a formal procedural notion seems to me to go at once too far and yet not far enough. It goes too far because only certain kinds of reason, namely those of a discursive, argumentative kind, are allowed within the communicative era or within public space, either ignoring or subordinating the numerous other forms of communication, affective, gestural, and essentially practical, in contrast to the theoretical, by which humans relate to one another. This faith in the world as an academic seminar is touching, and perhaps to philosophers flattering, but given the real conflicts of the world, not very persuasive. It does not go far enough, however, because the prior and difficult work of establishing sufficient intercultural communication and the structures for a cross-cultural hermeneutics to see the reasonableness of radically other beliefs and cultures is short-circuited by these formal transcendental modes of argument. The problem of intercultural understanding is not one that can be bridged by these formal transcendental approaches, especially when one considers cultures where reality is thought to transcend phenomenological and conceptual orders without necessarily invalidating them at their appropriate level. The difficulty is one of trying to bridge the distance between radically different and relatively incommensurable worlds, that is, worlds which lack a common set of rules by which statements can be understood and their truth value assessed. The great challenges of intercultural communication are still ahead of us as political and economic power moves in the coming decades to East Asian and Southern countries. The root problem is political and has to do with asymmetries and imbalances of power which shape and structure the production and reception of knowledge. Until those imbalances are corrected, the study of non-European cultures is going to be assigned, as in our universities, both in Britain and the United States, to the area of language and area studies, all right, on the assumption that they have little to contribute to mainstream philosophy and social science or hermeneutics. I might point out that in all of the United States at the moment, with some easily 300 to 500 universities, there are only 4 or 5 universities where Indian philosophy is taught in philosophy departments. In every other instance, including in places like Berkeley, where this used to be the case with Pichetal and others, it's now moved to area studies. So that tells you something. Second, otherness and difference. Again, at least in theory, we have moved a long way from the identitas logik of Hegel in the direction of at least acknowledging differences that are irreducible to the logic of the same. The rise of both hermeneutics and deconstruction has brought home the lesson that it is only in genuine encounter with what is alien and other that we can gain understanding both of the others and ourselves. The other, as Immanuel Levinas put it, is an other with an alterity that is not formal, is not the simple reverse of identity, and is not formed out of resistance to the same, but is prior to every initiative, to all imperialism of the same. It is the other with an alterity constitutive of the very content of the other, and therefore irreducible by definition to the same. Such irreducibility means that gaze is now met by gaze, narrative by narrative, and criticism by counter-criticism. The empire, as Salman Rushdie has put it, writes back. Of course, given the asymmetries of power, much of this writing is done by authors trained in the West, who are often as distanced from their own cultures as their Western colleagues, and speak a language that is quite removed from the struggles and concerns of the truly marginalized. But at least it is a step in the right direction. Third, the temporal and spatial distancing. Many of the ploys adopted by Hegel, namely relegation to an archaic past, supersession and absorption within a developmental scheme, the pushing to the margins those seen as radically different, are now, of course, seen through. More and more, the methodological norm in cultural and social studies is, as expressed by Johannes Fabian, quote, to meet the other on the same ground in the same time. The acknowledgement of genuine differences and the different forms of relativism it has spawned no longer allow for the developmentalism that, as the Indologist Ron Inden has expressed it, culminate in Homo Euro-Americanus. And finally, number four, the relation of the knower and the known. Here too, the new pluralistic climate has demonstrated the illegitimacy of many of the moral and epistemic assumptions underlying Hegel's project. A, where Hegel treats the other as ultimately an object, a pluralistic orientation demands an intersubjective methodology where others are seen as subjects in their own right and not just as phases within an evolutionary scheme. B. Intersubjectivity demands that those described be able at least to recognize themselves, even if they do not agree with a description that is proffered. C. Where they do not agree with this description, they should be allowed to contest the description on their own terms, instead of being forced to speak a particular privileged language. And D. Genuine intersubjectivity also disposes of the pretension of omniscience, often couched in terms like scientific, universal, and necessary. Of course, the particular problems of intercultural hermeneutics, in contrast to intracultural hermeneutics, is precisely the bridging of the large gap between cultures, especially if we see cultures epistemically as providing the horizon within which reality is seen and worlds are constructed. Here, where a real encounter and interaction is called for, it does not seem to me to be particularly useful to go transcendental, as Jürgen Habermas and Karl Otto Appel tend to do. Instead of laying down transcendental conditions, which in any case are fluid, it seems to be more helpful to think seriously about actual cross-cultural dialogue. By what rules should such dialogue be structured? They have themselves to be negotiated in the encounter rather than being specified a priori as preconditions. The laying down of transcendental conditions is all too often a hedge against and an escape from the messiness of open-minded, ongoing dialogue. It is a remnant in milder form of the same intellectual colonialism that Hegel practiced. And finally, and this is a very brief section, the third and what I'm calling the global movement. We may think of Hegel's hermeneutics as a hermeneutics of supersession and triumphalism, with its suggestion that while the sun rises in the east, it sets in the west, and it is from the west that the owl of Minerva flies. The question of conceptual standards and criteria for the evaluation and comparison of diverse cultural traditions has been adjudicated by the course of history in favor of the West. Thus, it is the historical responsibility of Europe to provide the context and the categories for the evaluation of all cultures and traditions. A full century after Hegel, Edmund Husserl will claim in The Crisis of the European Sciences that the Europeanization of all foreign peoples is the historical destiny of the world. And this is a sentiment that his student Heidegger also repeats. According to Husserl, Europe alone can provide other traditions with a truly normative framework of meaning and understanding, because Europe uniquely, thanks to its heritage from the Greeks, has true philosophy and a universality beyond what Husserl calls merely empirical and anthropological cultures, such as the Chinese and the Indian. Husserl writes this text of the crisis, a very important text, in 1938. All right, so see, a full century after Hegel. So when I spoke about the Hegelian legacy, you could see that I wasn't exaggerating. It is not surprising, therefore, that when these and other countries in the Third World got their independence, the long-established hegemonic worldviews were challenged in the work of post-colonial thinkers like Edward Said, Homi Bhabha, Cornel West, Lucius Outlaw, and many others. Gaze is now met by gaze, narrative by narrative, the empire, as Salman Rushdie writes back. There is now a hermeneutics of suspicion and contestation that prevails. Nevertheless, the more perceptive critics of postcolonial theory have observed that these writers still operate in a largely westernized setting under conditions shaped by Western modes of discourse. Hence the reference in their theorizing to Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Gilles Deleuze, Antonio Gramsci, and Jürgen Habermas, but very rarely, if at all, to Abhinava Gupta, Nagarjuna, Shankara, Ramanuja, among ancient Indian thinkers, or even to Gandhi, Tagore, or Aurobindo among the moderns. The postcolonial critique is largely a reactive stance responding to modern Western claims. The late Indologist and philosopher Wilhelm Halbfass poses one of the central questions that postcolonial discourse has to face. This is a quote from Halbfass. The medium, the framework for any dialogue, seems to be an irreducibly Western one. But is this factually inescapable universality the true telos of mankind, as Husserl indicates. Could it be that the global openness of modernity is still a parochially Western European horizon? Or has Europe itself somehow been left behind by the universality which it has inaugurated? In a sense, Europe itself has been superseded and left behind by the modern westernized world. It is no longer the master of the process of Europeanization. The direction of this process, the meaning and value of progress, the significance of modern science and technology have become thoroughly questionable. The doubts and questions about the direction of the modern West, which had been raised by the Romantics, by Schopenhauer and others, has become much more urgent. The search for alternatives now appears as a matter of life and death. This is from Halbfass's India and Europe. So, the last two pages, what I call, in somewhat cursory form, the global conversation of humankind. It is not sustainable any longer to have a hermeneutics of supersession, as with Hegel, or a hermeneutics of suspicion or contestation, as in the post-colonial moment. We have entered into a new age, the global age, where we need to create a new hermeneutics towards what the British political philosopher Michael Oakeshott once called the great conversation of mankind. This new hermeneutics will be a hermeneutics of true intersubjectivity between subjects who share a basic equality and on that basis can attempt a genuine dialogue where Martin Buber's I-thou dialectic is reciprocally deployed. That is, the I-thou positions change, and each partner in this dialogue is sometimes an I and at other times a thou. The need for such a dialogue is provided by the critical global situation in which we find ourselves. All the urgent problems that plague us today, environmental degradations, hunger and poverty, the spread of terrorism, the threat of nuclear weapons, sustainable development, peace and security, and environmental sustainability, are global problems which require the global wisdom of humankind. No longer will the particular perspective of singular cultures be sufficient to solve these global problems. This new situation in the history of humankind will call forth at least two responses. A, the diachronic dialectic of tradition and modernity and the search for alternative modernities, as one sees in the thought of Gandhi, Vivekananda, Aurobindo and Tagore, to mention the most consequential 19th and 20th century Indian thinkers. And B, a true cross-cultural conversation in a synchronic space. These two dialectics in interaction may go some way towards initiating the global conversation that Oakeshott heralded, and as I said, I'll deal with some of these problems in next Monday's seminar. So, thank you. Sorry for a rather long paper, but yeah. Thank you, Jason. Well, that was really interesting.